From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll look at the impact of gerrymandering on polarization. Then, three Milwaukeeans, including WUWM's Lena Tran, explore Asian identity.
I mean, for a lot of us, in the absence of language, you know, we have food. And it helped me feel connected to my grandparents when I couldn't really communicate with them.
We'll go behind the scenes at the Milwaukee Public Museum and learn about their collection of birds.
They're active and they're dynamic, and you know, good taxidermy really makes a huge difference when you're trying to tell those animal stories.
Plus, Bubbler Talk looks into why there are sunken gardens in some of Milwaukee's medians. All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Politics in Wisconsin and in the nation often boils down to an us versus them mentality. But how did we get here? There are a few answers to that, which we explore in the latest episode of WUWM's podcast, Swing State of the Union. One answer? Gerrymandering. In 2011, Wisconsin Republicans created gerrymandered maps to solidify their control of the state legislature for at least a decade. David Daly is the author of Rat Effed, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy. It explores the plan to gerrymander district maps in key swing states, known as Project Red Map. He joins Swing State of the Union hosts Joy Powers and Sam Woods to explain how Red Map changed the landscape of American democracy and heightened political polarization, especially here in Wisconsin.
We're going to start with a really open question here, but how do you describe gerrymandering?
Gerrymandering is the oldest political trick in the book, and it allows politicians to choose their own voters, to draw their own districts. And it takes that power away from the people who should have it, who are the voters. And when that happens, it changes the very nature of representation. And it really changes the very nature of the founding tenets of the nation, in which we are supposedly a nation under which the people choose their leaders, and the leaders operate with the consent of the governed. Gerrymandering turns that on its head.
How did gerrymandering, or at least the ability to gerrymander with such precision as it is done today, evolve during the 2000s?
We've had gerrymandering for as long as we've had politicians, and it's been an evil in our politics for that entire time. But what happened in 2010 really is a story of gerrymandering on steroids. It's a story of what happens when the will of politicians to hold power collides with new technology, with big data, and with a changing demographics of a multiracial nation. And all of this together really gives Republicans the impetus to go ahead and try to use redistricting as a very different kind of political tool in 2010, really a blunt force weapon. But they were able to turn redistricting into that kind of blunt force weapon because of the new precision power of the technology that had come online that allowed map makers to draw these districts that were essentially unbeatable for a decade to come by combining these new software programs like Maptitude, which was used in Wisconsin, a super high-tech program, so granular, allows you to just zero in house by house with the data attached to that, of knowing who lives in all of those houses, which elections they voted in over time, maybe matching that up to the magazine subscriptions that you've bought, Do you have a hunting license in the state of Wisconsin? Do you subscribe to Guns and Ammo or The New Yorker? Armed with that kind of information, mapmakers can go up and down streets and choose precisely who they want in these districts and who they want on the other side. Politics are no longer responsive to the people. Elections no longer matter. And it really handed over control of the state to the people who had mapped it for an entire decade.
So let's dig in a bit to Project Red Map. What were the targets of this overall operation?
Project Red Map was perhaps the most important political strategy of our lifetimes. And I don't think you can understand modern American politics without understanding what Red Map created. Red Map stands for the Redistricting Majority Project. It was the brainchild of a Republican strategist named Chris Jankowski, who worked at something called the Republican State Legislative Committee. And Jankowski came out of state politics. He understood the importance of state politics at a time in which most consultants of both parties wanted to play at the national level. They liked the bright lights, big city of presidential politics or big Senate campaigns. Jankowski liked the nuts and bolts of what you could do in a state legislature. And after the 2008 election, in which Barack Obama takes the White House, the nation's first Black president, Democrats win a supermajority in the U.S. Senate. It's hard to believe now, but it's true. And Democrats win big numbers in the U.S. House and state houses around the country. And if you go back and if you look at the TV coverage of that night, you see the smartest minds in American politics on both sides of the aisle talking about how the multiracial coalition that Obama built was going to become the dominant force in American politics for a generation, that Republicans could be on the outs for cycle after cycle to come. And what Chris Jankowski realized, not that night, but really soon thereafter, was that as important, as historical as the 2008 election had been, the 2010 election held the possibility of being much more consequential, because it was a census year, and what follows the census but redistricting. And that if you could run a political strategy that won back every seat at the table in the most important states around the country, you could draw maps that remade the politics of all of those states. So Red Map, with the help of about $30 million in donations from a lot of big corporations, there's a little bit of Coke money involved, some dark money that's made possible after the Citizens United decision earlier in 2010. Really, it becomes a strategy targeted at flipping as many state legislative chambers around the country in swing states, Wisconsin, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Florida, Indiana, Alabama, which was under Democratic control at the time. And by winning about 107 state legislative races in 17 states, Republicans realized that they would have the power to draw a huge majority of the U.S. House, as well as all of those state legislative maps. It was going to be a massive advantage in a changing nation. And what they understood was that the power to draw the lines gave them the power to try to hold back the changing demographic and political waves of a changing nation.
And so what did the redistricting process look like in Wisconsin? And how does it compare to those other states that were part of Project Red Map?
Wisconsin drew its maps behind closed doors under a veil of secrecy with the help of massive supercomputers and the most precise data sets that had ever been available to mapmakers in our history.
How has gerrymandering affected what representation looks like in Wisconsin, because as you mentioned, we used to have elections that would often flip the legislature, both the House and the Senate. How has that representation been affected in the year since the 2010 redistricting process?
Really, all you have to do is look at the results of those elections. 2018 is probably the most clear example of the power of these lines. It's a big Democratic year in the state of Wisconsin, as it was around the country. You get a Democratic governor, you get Democratic statewide candidates at every level, you see the re-election of Tammy Baldwin. Democratic candidates for the state assembly win somewhere between 199 to 203,000 more votes than Republican candidates, and yet Republicans hold 65 of the 99 seats. So this is the power of redistricting. And I think the power of redistricting has become brilliantly clear to everybody who lives in the state of Wisconsin, because you've seen the impact on public policy. And I think sometimes nationally, however, people think of gerrymandering as just sort of a partisan game. And I think what you've seen in Wisconsin is the real life effects of what happens in a state when elections no longer matter and can no longer bring about change, and when politicians no longer fear consequences at the ballot box. You get a different breed of politician. The kind of person who got elected as a Republican to the Wisconsin Assembly in the years following the 2011 redistricting, these aren't your local Chamber of Commerce Republicans anymore. These turn into the kinds of Republicans who deny elections. These turn into the kind of legislators who feel so invulnerable, so immune to the people, that they can gavel in and gavel out of special sessions called to force action on issues like guns and reproductive rights, voting in the middle of a pandemic, that have popular support in the 60s and 70s, as shown by the Marquette poll in the state of Wisconsin. And that is really dangerous. That, I would say, is terrifying. And I wonder how we would cover this same story if it happened in another country. But it is happening right here in the United States of America, in the purple state of Wisconsin, where gerrymandering and redistricting began by giving Republicans a leg up. And over the course of several years, what you really saw was an authoritarian power grab and the complete severing of any possibility of voters doing anything about it at the ballot box.
That was David Daley, the author of Rat Eft, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy, speaking with Joy Powers and Sam Woods for WUWM's podcast, Swing State of the Union. You can hear the full episode on political polarization at WUWM.com or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also tune in tomorrow at noon right here on 89.7 WUWM. This is the last week of AAPI Heritage Month, and to mark the occasion, we're bringing you local voices talking about their experiences growing up in and around Milwaukee and trying their best to fit in, even in their own cultures. Here's Lake Effect's Jibby Gutierrez and WUWM's Lena Tran.
Hi, Lena.
Hi, Jimmy.
How are you?
I'm good.
So you haven't been in the studio a whole bunch, which is wild to me.
I know. This is a foreign space.
Because I hear your voice all the time and I love everything you produce.
That is so nice of you to say.
I don't know if you know this, but we're wrapping up Asian Heritage Month.
The best month. I know.
The best month. Also, like, I love it because it's getting warm and I'm forgetting that it even was cold at one point. But something that's been interesting to me is that a lot of my friends have brought this up and they've talked about this for a while, but this kind of feeling that they're not Asian enough or they don't feel Asian enough.
That is so real. I think that, you know, feeling a little out of place, whether you're first gen, second gen. I have aunts and uncles who immigrated here like as really young kids from Vietnam. You know, I think it's something that a lot of Asian Americans can relate to. I know I can for sure.
What is your background, if I can ask?
Yeah. So my mom is Thai and my dad is Vietnamese. And we have a huge family, like cousins on cousins on cousins. I grew up with all of them living in my hometown in Alabama.
Alabama,
a really small town in Alabama. It was really white and my high school was really segregated. So
we know that story.
If people saw any Asians walking around town, they probably assumed that they were my family members, and they were probably correct. Like, that's what we were working with.
Okay, understood. That sounds like a lot. And I can't imagine how confusing that would have been, like, growing up and trying to make sense of things. How did you feel like you fit in, or how did you kind of make space for yourself, or how did your family make space for themselves?
My grandparents worked really hard and eventually opened a restaurant that everyone in the family worked at. And, you know, we were a big part of the church. People knew our family, and I felt really proud to be, like, one of the trans. But I think so often I, like, think about how it was to be in that kind of family and be, like, kind of standing out. Mm-hmm. And it was, like, so often I saw us on, like, other people's terms, on, like, white people's terms. Mm. Like, I knew that we were different, but I didn't really understand how until I left home and was a lot older. I knew that we were different, but I also didn't know that it was, like, something that I could be proud of.
You know, that story reminds me of Kayla Kuo's story. And she's Taiwanese and grew up around Milwaukee, but she's also a transracial and transnational adoptee, which basically means she was raised and adopted by a white family. And has never met her birth family. And she said that growing up, she rejected her Asian-ness, even actively tried to assimilate to whiteness.
And so, to be honest, I didn't even think about race or not identifying as white until I went to college and was just surrounded by so many people of color and introduced to so many different ethnicities and cultures and just experiences that I had never even thought about or thought were possible for me. I do have a younger sister who's also a Korean adoptee. And it's so wild because I feel like growing up, people would tell us that my sister and I looked alike, which is like, of course, we kind of clung to that because the idea of being able to have representation or to feel this like familiarity with someone else was really lovely. But now the older I get and the more I think about it, it's just like, we absolutely look nothing alike. It was just people weren't exposed to or don't know that even the like minor differences between like someone who is Taiwanese and someone who's Korean. Growing up, I feel like my parents never exposed my sister and I to any like Asian dishes. I remember like growing up on Hamburger Helper and Rice-A-Roni and you know these like staple American pantry dishes, but like the closest that we ever got was like going to PF Chang's for our birthday and eating like lettuce wraps and the sweet and sour chicken. And so like I feel like I had a lot of growing to do in terms of understanding my racial identity because of what I wasn't exposed to. Even going to like the Asian grocery store, like I want to get to a place where I feel like I belong and that I feel welcome there, but still, even when I walk in, like I just get easily overwhelmed with all of the different labels and all of these words that I can't read. And so for me, I think it's also letting go of this shame of not having grown up speaking Mandarin Chinese or even Taiwanese. It's a continuous process of like learning how to let go of that shame and also give myself the experiences that I never had.
Yeah, not having a language connection is really painful. And like for me, it meant not being able to talk to my grandparents or feeling left out when my mom and aunts and cousins started speaking in Thai. Because in my family, like my siblings and I didn't learn our parents' languages, but we have some cousins that did. So there was this whole like spectrum of like some people who have that access and some people that don't. And it felt really bad to be someone that did.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Yeah. The lack of language also makes it hard to access your family history. You know, I have friends who have photos of like their great, great, great grandmother, and they have stories that are passed down, you know, generation to generation. And I barely knew my grandparents' full names until very recently. You know, there's like so many questions that I have that were very difficult to ask.
Well, I know there were people that were kind of rejected parts of them, like Kayla kind of talks about. Like you were saying with the language and just kind of like trying to piece things together, I do know of people that really like latched onto any part of their Asianness that they could in places that didn't have a lot of Asian representation.
Yeah.
And for that, I'm thinking of Adam Carr.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you met Adam Carr. He's from Milwaukee. He'll tell you that himself within the first minute that you meet him. But he's half Irish and half Chinese. And of all the places he could find representation, he found it in pop culture, even if sometimes it was a bit of a problem.
You know, as a little boy, you're interested in fighting, right? Like at French immersion school, we were just fighting all the time. That's what we like to do. But like, so ninjas were appealing to me. I think they're generally appealing. And then like the movies we'd watch, like we're still the American ninja and it's like a white guy becoming a ninja. And then all the Asian guys are bad guys and just like the one white guy's a good guy. And then American Ninja 2, same. Did not change the formula. They didn't broaden their idea of what American could be at all. And then it took until Wu-Tang. It quickly became apparent. I'm listening to Wu-Tang. They know so much more about Chinese stuff than me. At least they were watching Kung Fu movies where everyone was Chinese. And it took, and Wu-Tang was like, yeah, you can like that too. And I was like, oh, interesting. Culture was a contact sport at NPS. In our era especially, I would grow up in super multicultural environments where it was also like, okay, I'm gonna learn about these cultures' weak points. Like, what? And by that I mean like, what are the stereotypes? So here's my choice. Do I learn to take it from someone, or do I learn to like get out ahead of the ribs and sort of like, my mom does not have an accent. But I'm sure, well, I know in high school, like she did when it was worth, you know, getting some laughs, right? Which, you know, it's regrettable in retrospect, but like, it's like, oh, I could claim those. So there are a lot of things I couldn't say and I never will say, and that's great. And I'm happy not to say them. But then there are some taboo things I can say.
Too real. Like, if you can't beat them, join them.
Dude, it's a dog-eat-dog world in those MPS hallways. I'm telling you. But luckily we grow up and we find ways to accept ourselves fully. Kayla did. For her, it was in books, and that transformed the way that she saw herself and the world around her.
When I was like in eighth grade or freshman, books for me really became a way to escape reality and to follow these fun, magical adventures of friendship and the possibilities of what could be. And so Harry Potter was kind of like my opening into my deep love for books and like that thread of why I want to read, which is often coming back to reading for pleasure and like reading to learn and to understand. And so it wasn't until like even after college that I finally had, you know, time to read again for fun. But when I was on this, you know, consistent journey of decentering whiteness, I realized that a lot of the books that I was reading were either written by white authors and or featured like white straight protagonists. And so it was really important for me to get away from that or to realize that, you know, there's this whole other world that exists. And so I started my Bookstagram almost 3 years ago now, and that was a way specifically for me to be more intentional about finding more Asian and Asian American authors and not only supporting them, but also finding myself in these stories.
Adam says that his mom was his tether, and he sought out the Asian community around Milwaukee, the same one that his mom was a leader in. And one thing they always had in their house to ground them was food.
What our family calls chow mein is not what you order on a restaurant menu. It isn't the sort of like the noodles that are sort of crusty and then you get them in sauce and then they soften up and they can be very nice. But these are kind of these twice fried noodles that have a special sauce. It's kind of derived from soy sauce. And my mom would make them for the most special occasions. So maybe like once or twice a year. Like there were five of us, so it couldn't be for birthdays. And if like you got it for your birthday, everyone else was mad, but you'd still eat the chow mein. The next day we'd always like, we're a sleepy family. We'd wake up as early as we possibly could to eat that chow mein because it would not make it to like noon. It would not make it to lunch. Like if chow mein made it to lunch, it's because some of the family was out of the house. Like it was impossible, especially when we were all there. But chow mein was just like, my eyes just got big thinking about it. Like it would be smoky and it would be long, like hot, and she'd do it in summer and it'd be all sweaty. But the chow mein feels like where I'm from. I didn't really know where I was from, but I could eat some noodles and feel good.
I mean, for a lot of us, in the absence of language, you know, we have food. And it helped me feel connected to my grandparents when I couldn't really communicate with them. My grandfather, we called him Ong, he passed away a few years ago. And his younger brother's entire family came to town for the funeral. This was like a 20-person branch of the family that we didn't know that well.
Where were they coming from?
They were coming from like Florida and Kentucky, kind of all over the place, but we just didn't see them that much. To me, they just seemed more Vietnamese than us in this really hardcore way. That was cool, but you know, in my family, we have a lot more mixing, and they were just like fully Vietnamese, and all the kids could speak the language. They wanted to honor Ong because he helped them evacuate from Vietnam and come to the U.S. in the 70s. So before the funeral, they cooked us this huge pot of bung bao hue. It was like a pot that you could like fit a small child into. It was so big.
Okay.
It's this spicy lemongrass noodle soup. It was so amazing. They like took over the entire kitchen. They put like newspapers on my parents' floor so that they wouldn't spill or make a mess. And they were all like squatting on the floor and like cleaning out the herbs for our soup. And it was crazy. It was like seeing this alternate universe of what our family could have been. And it was like festive and beautiful, and I felt connected to them. But at the same time, I was like, part of this is unfamiliar. So like at the same time that there is connection, you're feeling like the absence of something too.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a part of this that feels maybe that both feet aren't fully planted in one space or one identity. There's growth. There's been change. And for Adam and Kayla, I know that they had a few things that they wish their younger selves would have heard.
Give yourself permission to do all of the things or all of the experiences that you weren't denied, and to be open to possibilities. For me, like the experiences that I'm giving myself are being able to learn Mandarin. Later this year, I'm going to be visiting Taiwan for the first time since I was adopted at 4 months old, which is both like a very exciting and thrilling and anxiety-inducing time. But also, you know, things that don't necessarily cost money or as much money is being able to go to the library. And I've read and checked out so many children's books, specifically children's books that had more like Asian and Chinese protagonists or characters, but also as I've started learning Mandarin, like checking out bilingual books and being like, maybe these were things that my adoptive parents could have read with me. And so just having those tools has been really helpful.
Get into Wu-Tang sooner, as soon as you can. So, young Adam, get Wu-Tang into your life. I'd actually say you're doing good. I'm proud of you.
I guess that I tell my younger self to get comfortable with like the discomfort and learn to poke at some of this like messiness earlier, because I feel like me and my parents and family members have kind of started talking about this more recently, but like we could have used the practice. Like I wish they had started earlier.
More practice for everybody.
More practice for everyone. We need it.
Yeah. Okay. I think we can leave like on a high note and feel good about this.
Yeah. And we don't have to try again until next year.
Yeah, we've got a year to figure this out.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was Adam Carr, Kayla Kuo, and WUWM's Lena Tran. That piece was produced by Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez. In about 10 minutes, we'll learn how sunken gardens and street medians help to manage stormwater. But first, we'll learn about the Milwaukee Public Museum's bird collection. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. At the Milwaukee Public Museum, millions of artifacts that aren't on display are stored in backroom drawers and cabinets. As part of our series Behind the Scenes at MPM, today we'll explore the zoology department's vast bird collection. Julia Colby is the museum's zoology curator. She says many of the specimens are used for research and that some of the collection will be displayed for the first time at the Future Museum. Colby met with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and WUWM's Eddie Morales to share the history and the future of MPM's bird collection.
About how many items in the Milwaukee Public Museum's collection are in the zoology department?
It's about 2 million specimens. That's a rough estimate. Some of them are, you know, drawers and drawers and drawers of insects, which we think we've counted accurately, but I think that there's some material there that is not, you know. So it's about 2 million, though, total.
How much of that ends up actually on the floor?
Less than 1%. It's a tiny, tiny amount. And a lot of it, as we'll talk about here in a little bit, is just if we put them on display, like what would the public get out of them versus the harm to the object or the space that we'd take to display it? It's just not evocative. It doesn't help us tell the story that we want to tell. And so it doesn't really serve a purpose to be out.
It's interesting. So I'm looking at some of the collection, and this is from Delavan, mm-hmm. Wisconsin, Walworth. And then I'm also seeing these are all orioles, right?
Yes. These are, who are these guys? Black-headed Scots, hooded, and orchards. The orchards I think you find around here. The other ones I think are western or eastern,
yeah,
the orchards.
Arizona.
Yeah, so side. We do have, this is a synoptic collection. It covers most of the U.S. It's not every bird that occurs in the U.S., but we would have either purchased or traded or sent people out to collect material for us. And around the turn of the century, it was very common and not unusual at all to have a private collection like this. And so we would have purchased those as they became available as well.
So looking at this today, mm-hmm. you said, you know, a lot of the collection looks different when it's a modern collection, but how is this kind of collection used in modern research?
So we get requests. Often people want data, so they might want where occurrence has been historical occurrence data. So has this species range changed because of human influences like habitat loss? Has the range changed because of climate change? You know, you can map out historical points on a map and you can say, okay, this is where they were. Are they still there? You can look at migration data with these. So this is a lot of North American birds migrate from Central and South America every year, sometimes as far as like the Arctic Circle in Canada. And they will stop off along in Wisconsin to refuel and rest. And so that's when we tend to see them, and maybe we don't see them at all for the rest of the year, except for those two times when they're coming up in the spring and going down in the fall. But some of them don't make it. And so having those points tells you, okay, this is the earliest record that we have for, you know, whatever kind of warbler it is. And here's the latest, and that tells you their migration range, and that can help you determine what that migration route looks like, when they come up, maybe who they co-migrate with. And if you have enough of these collections, so using just our collection gives you a little wedge of that data, but if you go to collections all over the country, it gives you the rest of that picture. And you can start to get further data from there. You can also do things with these collections like we do allow people to come in and do with, you know, they got to do some paperwork to do it, but, you know, you can get some DNA out of specimens like this. We're very cautious about that because it is destructive sampling. You can look at mites. We have an albatross that is unfortunately not accessible at the moment, but he's got mites, you know, he's got little lice all over him. not all over him, they're not crawling, but you know, he does have, there are a couple spots where you can see that there's a bird louse, and who knew that an albatross gets bird lice, and how are you going to go catch that albatross and study that bird lice, you know? So it's very useful for a lot of stuff. It's just those things are not quite as so obvious as what bird is this, and you know, how big do they get, that sort of stuff.
It's amazing how many, because I assume all of these lockers are just full of these drawers with different little guys.
Yes. So this is, as I said, this is our North American bird collection. So it starts over on the other side with ducks and geese, and then it goes all the way up into like the little, what we would consider songbirds. And the collection is arranged taxonomically. So everything that's closely related is closer together, and everything that's more distantly related is further apart. So this is the beginning of like the blackbirds. It goes into owls, we get into raptors down at the end, and then on this side we get into shorebirds and waders and stuff like that. So it's a big, extensive collection. It's heavily Wisconsin, but there is stuff from all over the country in it.
Is there any other benefit to having them in a more posed position versus the kind of, you know, laid out flat?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is how people relate to them. They're just so much more relatable when they look like an animal that you can look out your back window and see. And it's just much easier to interpret them. I think people empathize with them a little bit more. So if you're talking about conservation, it's much easier to say, you should conserve this bird you see all the time versus you should conserve this bird that you see all the time, but it's just lying there. You know, it's just they're active and they're dynamic. And, you know, good taxidermy really makes a huge difference when you're trying to tell those animal stories. And so that's sort of the benefit and why we would have those, you know, we might have a drawer of orioles down here, but we have five or six boxes of orioles up there because they're a common bird here and it's very easy to interpret them and go from there.
Can you talk a little bit about what you're expecting when it comes time to move to the Future Museum?
Yeah, so this is actually our first collection that we're getting ready to move, my first collection that we're getting ready to move. We're going to hire some folks to do inventory so we know exactly what we are packing when we pack it. So they're going to go through, they're going to check it off on the list, verify some data to make sure they've got the right specimen in front of them. It gets a barcode that will just be tied around the legs gently, and then we'll know how many orioles we have, what drawer they're in, what cabinet they're in. This material is easy-ish to move because you can move it in the drawer and then we'll just unload it. We'll either load it into new drawers and load those drawers into the cabinet, or we'll move it in these drawers and move them into the new cabinets. Some of the stuff, like the taxidermy, most of these are going on exhibit, but the taxidermy does get a little bit dodgier because you've got to, you know, you've got to keep it in the right orientation and you've got to keep it from tipping, and many of these are designed to be sort of clipped onto the wall. But it's, you just look at each one and sort of figure out how to do it and how to keep it supported and then go from there. I will say that it does keep me up at night, but it's not that bad. This is not the worst collection to move. This stuff is relatively hale and hardy and, you know, robust. There's some other collections where that's not the case, or they're just much more breakable, but this collection will be relatively easy.
You mentioned some of these items being on exhibit.
Yeah.
Will that be the first time that they've been on display?
I mean, other than being loaned out in classrooms, I don't think anything, these, you know, were never in cases at the old museum or even in this museum. So I think that these will be on display for the first time, essentially. In these collections were largely built for exhibit. That's what they were collecting for primarily, other than the scientific specimens. And so they definitely had an eye to the best things, but I don't know that any of these have ever been on exhibit. There would be certainly a lot of them if there were. It would just be a whole museum of birds.
What can people expect with how this department will have a space in the Future Museum?
I mean, so these birds, as an example, since we're talking about them, there is, I don't know, I haven't seen the final like renderings of this yet, but we're talking about an exhibit called Migration South, which runs through one of the Wisconsin galleries, and up above is the migration of birds going south. Because most of these birds do not live here year-round. They live in they winter somewhere else, and they come up here in the summers to take advantage of the fact that we have longer day length in the summer. And so they will be flying or perched in trees somehow. We haven't worked all that out. But they will be migrating south out sort of towards our rainforest in the new building.
What is it like repositioning a taxidermied bird?
So you can do it. Most of these will be, if they're perched, they're going to be perched. They'll just be resting.
on the branch. It is doable, but it's a lot of work. And with older stuff, it's sometimes it's very, very fragile. Or, you know, maybe it's perched like that because you can't be, it couldn't be flying because there's like a tear or a rip or it's missing some feathers or something. So we won't be doing a ton of that repositioning. Everybody will get cleaned and sort of prettied up and fixed if they need a little bit of fixing. But, you know, we're not going to be like wholesale making them all fly, even though that'd be cool. But it'd be a lot of work.
Julia Colby is the zoology curator at the Milwaukee Public Museum. She spoke to WUWM's Joy Powers and Eddie Morales. You can find more of WUWM's series Behind the Scenes at MPM at WUWM.com. In about 5 minutes, we'll tell you about Redner's Rescued Cat Figurine Museum in Menominee Falls. But first, we'll have the latest bubbler talk. Keep listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Audrey Nowakowski. With the arrival of spring, plants are blooming in our homes, our parks, and even in the middle of some Milwaukee streets. One WUWM listener wondered about those peculiar gardens and sent us this question for Bubbler Talk.
My name is Barbara Finley. In the last couple years, while driving along Milwaukee streets, I've noticed some gardens in the median strips. I was wondering why the gardens were being built below grade and what was being planted in them.
These sunken gardens and street medians are technically called bioswales, and they have a greater purpose beyond beautification. Kurt Sprangers with the Milwaukee Department of Public Works explains.
They are a stormwater management device. So the goal of the device is to collect water, hold it back, treat it, and then either release it back to the sewer system or to allow it to infiltrate.
Sprangers is in charge of environmental engineering for DPW. These bioswales, also called bioretention basins or rain gardens, were first installed in the city of Milwaukee in 2008. Since then, the city has built over 330 bioswales. You can identify them by looking for a depressed or sunken area in a street median that's planted with woody and herbaceous vegetation and a layer of mulch at the top. As rain seeps through the surface, it flows through an engineered soil made of sand and compost that provides drainage and nutrients for the plants.
And then below that further is what we call a stone storage layer. So it's usually 18 to 24 inches of clear washed stone, so it doesn't have any fines, it doesn't have any dust. And that acts as a storage area. So all the water that passes through the whole system, it's allowed to settle in the storage zone.
If rain is heavy enough to fill up the storage basin, the water drains back into the sewer system. You can see the importance of rain gardens when there's a heavy storm and paved streets become flooded. Porous surfaces that soak up the rain help prevent flooding and overflow of our sewage systems. And while bioswales are primarily for stormwater management, they also add more green space and beauty. Spranger says DPW tries to add as many flowering plants as it can, and all of the plants in bioswales are perennials.
So it's actually a mix of natives, cultivars, and non-natives. You know, we do try and incorporate natives when we can. Unfortunately, it is a very harsh environment. You know, it's in the middle of, say, a concrete road, which is getting a lot of sun all summer long. We're not getting a lot of rain. It can be a very dry environment. And then, of course, in winter, it's also a very salty environment. You're getting salt spray or water that, or salty water that's just running into the bioswales. So for that reason, we do mix up the types of plants that we use just to allow them to stay alive and thrive, essentially.
The funding for these bioswales comes from both the city and the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District. DPW does all the design, contracting, and maintenance work.
We do work with our forestry group to plan the plantings for each bioswale. So each one is unique, each one is different.
These bioswales are just one part of the City of Milwaukee's larger green infrastructure plan, which was introduced in 2019. And the data shows the plantings are doing their job.
One of the metrics within the plan is a goal of gallons of stormwater captured. And that actually is looking quite good. I believe we're at an 80% level of the 36 million gallons by 2030.
Spranger says bioswales will continue to be a priority as the city takes on new projects, including a host of street improvements.
That effort really just has become more and more important, in a sense maybe getting more aggressive with identifying locations where we can site bioswales and permeable pavers as part of paving projects. So you'll see some of the traffic calming projects that are going on. We're looking to see, you know, hey, how can we green those up a little bit so it's not just a plain concrete island?
So, like Bubbler Talk listener Barbara Finley, who spotted the bioswales and asked us about them, keep an eye out. Notice each unique garden, and you might see more of them cropping up soon.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from UW Credit Union. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
You can hear new episodes of Bubbler Talk Thursdays on Lake Effect and Fridays during Morning Edition. As the weather has been getting nicer, Milwaukeeans are taking day trips around the state to explore the many unique places Wisconsin has to offer. Less than an hour outside of the city, you can find one such site in Menominee Falls, Redner's Rescued Cat Figurine Museum. That's right, a museum. The cleverly named gallery is a pet project for founder Sean Redner, who donates all of the admission funds to rescue cat organizations. Sean joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to share more.
Tell us a bit about how you came up with the idea for this museum.
The museum itself wasn't actually supposed to happen. This all came out of me finding sobriety and needing something to do. So I had a lot of free time after I stopped drinking, so I started hunting for cat figurines at the various thrift shops. And eventually I had enough cabinets full that I decided it would be a great idea to try to help use the museum to help the cat rescues in the neighborhood. And that's when I said to my wife, I got a great idea. We're going to open the house to the public one day a month. We're going to ask for a $5 donation, and then we're going to donate the money away. So the museum itself was never the intention when the first few figurines were purchased.
What is it that you like about cat figurines?
Well, we have 9 rescue cats, but the cat figurines themselves have their own unique personality, and some of them have a lot of history behind them. So it just, you know, kind of went along with the cat rescues and the cats that we have.
So a lifelong commitment to cats.
No, it actually started when I moved to Milwaukee in 2008. The previous tenant had left her cats in the duplex I moved into, so I kind of just fell into the cat world on accident.
Interesting. Had you been a fan of cats previously?
I didn't really care or just, you know, dislike them. They were just kind of there.
Sure. So if someone comes to the cat museum, what are they going to see there?
Oh, we currently have roughly about 3,500 pieces of cat-related art, sculptures, wood carvings, cat figurines, cat dolls, cat light switch covers, if you name it, and it looks or resembles a cat, it's in the museum. There's really no limit to what you will see here. It's cat related. There's artwork, crocheting, a needlepoint, anything cat related has found a home here at the museum.
What do you think people would be most surprised to see at the museum?
Both the amount of stuff and how clean it is. We get that a lot. Like, I cannot believe you guys have 9 cats here.
Sure. Now, as you look around your collection of the many figurines, the art, all of the cat-related accoutrement, what sticks out to you the most? What are the pieces that you like the best?
Though I like the stuff that have people's signatures on it or their names. We have a picture of a black cat and a mime together, and on the back of it is a note to somebody's mother about Happy Mother's Day. So when we find things, because most of the stuff in the museum has been donated or comes from secondhand shops, when we find stuff that has a personal attachment to it, we tend to gravitate to liking that stuff more than your everyday run-of-the-mill cat figurine.
Sure. Now, you're currently just open one day a month, is that right?
Correct. We have one official open house a month, which falls on the third Sunday of each month, and that is from 11 to 5, where no appointment is necessary. But we also open by appointment Monday through Friday from 5 to 8 p.m. and anytime on the weekend after 11.
What's your biggest piece of advice for people who are interested in checking out the museum?
just give me a call. We will open the doors. We want to share this place with as many people as possible. The more people we can get in here, the more that we can donate back to the cat rescues.
All right. How much have you been able to donate so far?
Last year, we donated a little less than $2,000 is what the museum raised.
How much would you like to donate?
Oh, millions. There's never enough money in cat rescue. This was our second open house today, and we're off to a pretty good start. So, I mean, we can never donate enough money to them.
All right. Well, Sean, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Sean Redner is the founder of Redner's Rescued Cat Figurine Museum in Menominee Falls. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers last year. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, Excret Nunez, and Jimmy Gutierrez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Robert Larry. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Susan Vence, Lena Tran, and Eddie Morales from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon for an interview with beloved children's book author Kevin Henkes and illustrator Laura Dronzek. The husband and wife team just put out a new book, and we'll get some insights as to how they collaborate. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.